This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com. This week on Meet and Three, we're sipping on stories about how access, legislation, and circumstance affect what we drink.
I think now it's really changing that there's a growing excitement about drinks that are zero proof and alcoholic. So it just felt like kind of a very good timing.
This plant's been around for millions of years, and I just think that it's so special, so uniquely American and pre-American, that just should have a very prominent place in our society, you know, for a lot of different reasons.
It is helpful to be able to sell one drink. It would be more helpful to be able to sell two or three at a time.
Tune in to Meet and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Wednesday, March 10th, 2021. This is the 282nd episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is Eater's very own EIC and SVP at Vox Media, and I will introduce her fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to set goals and then work to achieve them. Take time to think about what you would like to undertake, both big and small, in the near future and more long term, and then focus on how to do so. Be sure to stay true to your mission and communicate your goals with others so they can be most supportive. Understand that with the right mindset, attitude, and dedication, you can accomplish anything. That's my tip today. Now, I'm really thrilled to have my guest joining me today. It is Amanda Clute. She is the editor-in-chief of Eater and a senior vice president at Vox Media. In her role as EIC, Amanda oversees all written, video, and audio content across the Eater network of sites, in addition to TV shows, events, and partnerships. In over a dozen years at Eater, she transformed the publication from a niche restaurant blog into one of the most authoritative food media brands, spanning dozens of cities and telling stories across multiple platforms. Eater has won multiple James Beard, National Magazine, and Emmy Awards. Without further ado, Amanda, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's I know it's been a while. I know I reached out to have you on my show in the past, and we finally are making it work. And I'm thrilled because I just want to dive into everything you're doing today and how you got there, because I'm thinking back to when I met you. Actually, I have this memory of Ben introducing us at a Village Voice event.
Makes sense.
And saying you were going to be the new, I think it was editor-in-chief at the time, but I really have that memory. But before we get into that, let's go a little further back with your background. Where did you grow up, and did you study journalism? Did you always want to be in media?
Sure. Yeah. So I grew up in the suburbs of Boston in Massachusetts, and I went to NYU, and pretty quickly decided to focus on journalism as my major, and all of my internships were at newspapers and magazines and journalistic outlets. So I didn't know right away going into college, but I figured it out pretty quickly thereafter. And also all through high school and college, I waitressed. So I had very intimate knowledge of, you know, the inner workings of restaurants, and restaurants always interest me. So I think this kind of combined the two.
Right. So you must have waitressed in the city then, which is amazing experience for sure.
I did. I waitressed a little bit in the East Village, actually at a bunch of different places in the East Village. And then when I was in Massachusetts, I waitressed for a long time at Friendly's, a beloved restaurant chain that I think has now gone bankrupt twice.
Oh, wow. I have prior experience from my high school days of waiting tables at Bennigan's and Chili's. So fond memories of that.
Yes. Similar vibes.
Yeah, exactly. We sang Happy Happy Birthday at Bennigan's. So I still know the tune. I don't know if you did that at Friendly's, but it's definitely a good, great experience to have. I always think back about those jobs. And I know for me, it's definitely restaurant experience has helped in what I do now with working with restaurants. So what then led you to Eater?
So out of college, I got my first job was at Metro, the free newspaper, not as a writer, but as their office manager. I tried to get a job as a writer there and there weren't any openings. So I took a position as office manager, but it allowed me to freelance quite a bit. And I spent all that time, I went to food writing classes. I tried to meet as many people as I possibly could. And that led me to a job at Grid Skipper, which was the travel publication for Gawker Media. And I was there for about a year. And at the time, the person running the editorial side of Gawker was Lockhart Steele, who was a co-founder of Eater. And back then, Eater was just a little side project of his, and Gawker was the real job. But eventually, he left Gawker to fully focus on Eater and sister sites Curbed and Racked. And I found out about after a year of Grid Skipper that they were looking for another New York editor. So in 2008, I moved over to Eater and became their associate New York editor. And I've been there ever since. So that was 13 years ago, just this February.
Wow, amazing. And yeah, and it was, I mean, Ben Leventhal and Lockhart Steele, I think they founded Eater. It was July 2005. So 3 years later, you're on board. And then what was mm-hmm. it like then? I mean, you know, at the beginning, how many people were on the team? What were your responsibilities? Obviously, they've changed tremendously over the years as the brand has grown.
Yeah, I mean, in 2008, when I started, it was a very small network of restaurant blogs. So we had one in New York, one in San Francisco, LA, Chicago, and Miami. And the New York team, it was about six people in a shared office space, kind of like a WeWork, before WeWork existed. And it was just Ben and myself covering New York, and I eventually got to take over writing the New York site, but it was very small and it was very bloggy. We were writing about restaurant openings and closings and chefs on the move, which is still part of our bread and butter now. It's just we cover so much more now. And then it was very fast-paced, very quick, a lot of posts every single day, usually not a ton of substance. It was very gossipy and very newsy.
Yeah, well, over the years, I started working for myself in 2003 and I was doing restaurant PR even before that. So I remember when it started, and I just know over all of these years, it's always been a must read, I would say, for someone who works in restaurant PR. And that, I think, says a lot for what it started as and how it's grown all these years. And I'm always thinking, I know because I'm based in New York and so are you, I'm always thinking I'm more Eater NY focused, but you are covering as mm-hmm. the editor-in-chief, you're responsible or overseeing all of the cities you're in. I don't even know, how many cities are you in now?
We have over two dozen now, and now we have a national site where we do a lot of long-form journalism, investigations, cultural critiques, and then we also have a video program, a couple television shows, a podcast. So it's really expanded in all kinds of ways, but it's still built on that DNA that you and I both know from, you know, the early aughts.
Yeah, true. So what's a day in the life typically, or a typical week maybe, with how you're overseeing all of the sites and all of your roles? Because I do also love your podcast, which I don't know, you were doing it weekly, but you now are doing it, I think, bi-weekly, but it's I look forward to it on Fridays.
Yeah, a typical week or a day is, I think, split between a lot of different responsibilities I have these days. So part of it is editorial and making sure I'm doing a good job leading our coverage and weighing in on how we are focusing our resources and attention across our city sites and what kinds of video work we're doing and everything happening on Instagram and social media. And then also doing my own creative projects like our podcast and my newsletter. But then another big chunk of my time is spent on some of the less glamorous parts of running a really big team. We have about 80 people, and I spend a lot of time talking to HR and talking to recruitment and trying to make sure our employees are supported and making sure they have what they need and dealing with any issues that come up with, you know, the team mechanics. And then I think the other big part of my job is the business side. Now that I have this silly title of SVP, but what it basically means is I now am more responsible for the business. So I need to be involved in the conversations we're having with advertisers and the way in which we're trying to diversify our business as a really big media company and as a growing publication.
I wouldn't say it's silly. I think it's a great title.
Impressive. <Thank you.
laughs> It's impressive. But yeah, and that's, I mean, you have a lot on your plate for sure. How have things changed this past year with the pandemic as far as, I'm assuming you do have a lot of Zoom calls. And it's hard to believe it's been a year. Hard to believe.
Yes, I'm on Zoom all day, every day. I'm one of those. So that's a lot. But yes, oh my God. I know, we're just coming up on that week. My life is definitely spent more on Zoom. There are a lot of problems that have been thrown our way that I never would have expected. Same as with anyone who's in, I guess, any industry, but definitely in media running a team. For the reporters, it's been a huge shift because our pillars have always been news and service, but we've definitely focused a lot more on news over the last year as it's become so crucial to restaurants and our audiences trying to figure out what's been going on. So I think it's kind of validated our model, which is having actual journalists on the ground in so many cities across the US to be able to cover this in an authoritative and useful way for people who are in those localities, because I think the pandemic has been so local. Even though we share a lot of the same issues and the same fears, it's very different living in New York than it is living in Miami right now.
Yeah. I know that one for sure. I actually just went down to Miami for the first time in a year to visit my family and saw the scene there. So, and I got back to New York and it was late at night. And the city was so quiet, and I forgot even just being away for a couple of days how, after 10 o'clock or 11 o'clock that the city is just shut down. It's not like what it was, but I know, like you, yeah. I'm a huge advocate or, you know, supporter of the industry and restaurants, and I've been trying to dine out and support as much as I can. And seeing the changes in the city have been, living here and seeing it is, it's been such a crazy experience. And your coverage at Eater, I have to say, you've done such a great job at covering what's happening with openings and unfortunately closings. And also on your podcast, I do really appreciate how you bring on editors from the different cities to talk about what's happening there, because that to me mm-hmm. has been really, it's been so informative if I'm not reading all of the city's, sites every day on Eater, but it kind of fills me in on what's happening in LA or New Orleans.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what is it, What is it about the restaurant industry that you love most covering? And then what would you say has been challenging over either now or most challenging now or over the years?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I've always loved covering restaurants because they're just so interesting and full of interesting characters. And people don't get into the business usually to make a lot of money. Most restaurants in America are independently owned and have fewer than 50 employees. And it's usually a place that's full of passion and character. And, you know, I love food, but the reason I've loved working at Eater is because it's not about the food. It's about the restaurant. It's about the vibe and the music and the design and the people who go there and how a restaurant fits into a certain neighborhood, into a certain city. And I just love all of those elements that you can dive into and the way that you can really expand upon coverage in so many different angles. So that's why I think I'll never get tired of restaurants. What makes it challenging now more than ever, but I think this has always been the case, is just I think the perspectives of people in the industry, we've always gotten criticism from them that we are not supporting them enough, that we are not enough of a cheerleader for them, which is not really our role. And then we also get criticism from the other side, people saying we, you know, all we do is publicity for restaurants and we aren't critical enough. And it's hard to square with the criticism, but I think it's with anything, you just have to listen and then follow your vision and your mission.
Yeah. That's, I would think that would be challenging. And that is, yeah, follow your mission for sure. Let me ask you my question from my last guest. On episode 281, I had on Hong Taimi. She is the chef and owner of Taimi Love, a pop-up now in the West Village. And she wants to know, what is the best way to enjoy a meal without expectations?
I think actually this pandemic has helped me learn to have no to low expectations going into a situation. Now, when I go to restaurants, I'm just looking forward to having any kind of interaction with that restaurant experience and with the person I'm with. And if the meal ends up being spectacular on top of that, or if the service ends up being spectacular on top of that, it's just a bonus, because I think we've learned just the value of being able to go out with one another and have someone else create an experience for us, that it's definitely made me less judgmental or picky or disappointed if things don't go my way than I would have been in the past.
Yeah, I hear you on that. I mean, I think this period has certainly taught us a lot and slowed us down, and also, I mean, appreciate things even more. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. What's next for Eater, if that you can share with us? I mean, what are you looking forward to, or are there any changes upcoming?
Yeah, I mean, this pandemic allowed us the opportunity to write more about how to engage with restaurants, how to engage with food in the home. So as soon as lockdown happened in March, we launched a section called Eater at Home, where we started to explore cooking in a way, but also just what it is to exist in the home, like shopping advice, technique advice, freezer advice, like what shows you should be watching and what podcasts you should be listening to. And I think there's such an audience and a desire for that kind of work that we're just going to lean into it over the next year and see if we can continue this going and bring our voice to a part of food media that is kind of saturated, but we still think there's a new way to approach it, and we can use it as kind of a way to fill out the rest of our coverage, which is more, you know, restaurant focused and focused on dining out.
Yeah, well, that's cool. I mean, and it made sense that you launched that. I mean, it was a needed service or resource for people that maybe we didn't see coming, but it came. So that's great. Okay, one more question before we take a little break. How about what's your advice? What's your advice for someone who wants to be a food journalist and not necessarily even work at Eater, maybe work at Eater, but just get into food or restaurant writing?
I mean, for aspiring food journalists, I think the key is to get out there, find stories, pitch as often as you can. Don't be dissuaded if the first pitch doesn't land. Reach out to people for connections and advice. And also just don't assume that everybody knows every story. Like, if you are really close, like, you know your neighborhood really well, you know all the people in your neighborhood, there's something interesting happening there, you are an expert in that and you should be pitching it. So I would just work really hard to find the angle and keep pitching, keep trying to connect with editors.
Awesome. Great advice. Okay, so let's take a little break. We'll come back and we'll have my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. I have my solo dining experience and the final question, so stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along, a three-day hosted virtual garden festival connecting you with the influencers, tastemakers, and cutting-edge content of today's gardening world. The Great Grow Along will feature 40-plus sessions on topics ranging from houseplants to DIY landscaping. New plant parents and first-time gardeners will gain practical advice and creative inspiration from celebrated garden experts and industry leaders. Costing $29.95, tickets allow attendees to mix and match a wide range of sessions, or choose to follow one of the conference's six tracks, which include edible gardening, urban gardening, pollinators and plants, DIY landscaping, houseplants, and dig deeper. The Great Grow Along will take place March 19th through 21st, 2021. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and my guest today is Amanda Clute. She's the editor-in-chief of Eater and a senior vice president at Vox Media. She also co-hosts the Eater's Digest podcast. And Amanda, it is now time for my speed round game. So what this is I'm going to name a couple of things and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla.
Cool.
You ready?
Yep.
All right, here we go. Eat in or eat out?
Eat out.
Wine, beer, cocktail, soft cocktail, or champagne?
Ooh, cocktail.
Tasting menu or a la carte?
A la carte.
Small plates or large plates?
I guess small plates.
Okay. How about communal table or chef's counter?
Oh, chef's counter, 100%.
I'm with you on that one. Okay. Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Ooh, I enjoy an all-inclusive. I love a tip-free restaurant.
All right. Cool. How about writing your newsletter or podcasting?
Oh, that's tough. Maybe my newsletter, because I get to cover a lot more in one editorial product.
Yeah, I have to say I love your newsletter. It's
Thank
really
you.
It's really well done, and I love that you provide the links and they're short little snippets. Like it's great. So I say,
love it.
Keep
Thank
at
you.
It.
Awesome.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay. Outdoor patio, tent, igloo, yurt, or any other, I don't know, the structure you've dined in.
I love a shed with an electric heater where there are intense divisions between tables. So you feel really safe, you're fairly warm, but you can still see the life around you. I find the yurts, you're a little cut off and it feels a little weird.
Okay, cool. I love that you're very specific on that.
As you know, I've been doing a lot of outdoor dining, so I feel like a true expert now.
Yeah, I know. It's changed a lot too with what's been available. So, okay, two more. I have a cheese plate or dessert.
Dessert.
And Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Oof, Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. Cool. That's the game.
It's fun. Love it.
Yeah. I love playing my game with people. Always different. Okay, so for industry news, it was obvious to me what the story was this week that we should talk about. And the first article that came out was in Time, and it's entitled, "The Senate Passed a $1.9 Trillion COVID-19 Relief Bill. Here's What's in It" by Alana Abramson. And this is talking about this new relief bill that includes relief for restaurants, which the Independent Restaurant Coalition has been fighting for, among other organizations. And that includes, the bill provides $28.6 billion in grant relief specifically for restaurants, which have been particularly decimated by this pandemic. So It's amazing. I mean, they've been working really hard on it for a long time.
Yes, it's incredible. So much in this bill is so incredible for so many people working in restaurants. I think that 28 plus billion in relief is huge, but there are other factors in the bill that will really change the lives of restaurant industry workers.
I agree. And they've been, you know, fighting for this whole year. And then, you know, I said this was the first piece I saw in it, but I saw today the Washington Post had an article by Tim Carman. And I also saw Ryan Sutton on Eater New York has an article that's entitled "What Biden's $1.9 Trillion Stimulus Bill Means for Restaurants Workers and Families." And I started looking through what Ryan wrote, because he always... he really broke it down and has
a lot
of
true wonk. Yes.
Yeah. I have to dive more into that later, but it's wonderful news. And I'm excited for restaurants, and I have to just give a shout out to the IRC and everyone that's been involved in it, and also Andrew Ridgey with the New York City Hospitality Alliance and the Restaurant Association. I mean, people have been working really hard this whole year to help save restaurants.
Yeah, and I think what's incredible about this versus the other relief efforts that have passed is that these are real grants. They're not loans that could be turned into grants, which is what PPP was. And also there's a potential here to have almost all of your losses relieved. So if you get this grant, you could really stand to survive in a world where maybe you wouldn't have otherwise. I think the big question is, will the, you know, almost $30 billion be enough given how big this restaurant is? Like, I know the IRC was originally looking for $120 billion, but still it's a huge number. I know there are a lot of other industries that are kind of bitter about it, you know, like the gym owners and other industries that did not get a special carve out. So it is huge for restaurant owners.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it's been challenging for so many industries. It just, and, I guess just being that we're what we do for a living, and just being so close to restaurants and seeing the struggle, it's I'm really glad that restaurants got the recognition and some help. But yeah, everyone needs help getting through this time. So, but it's a great exciting time. So, yeah. Okay, so one announcement I have, just heads up, my All in the Industry show here has been nominated for the Taste Awards in the Best Food or Drink Radio Broadcast category, and now is the time to vote for Viewer's Choice, because voting ends this Friday the 12th, so greatly appreciate it. If you want to vote for our show, you could go to heritageradionetwork.org/vote. And many thanks in advance. So it's time for my solo dining experience. So this week I have a really good one. I went to the chef in residence at Blue Hill Stone Barns with Chef Omar Tate. So here's the rundown. The location, 630 Bedford Road, Pocantico Hills, New York. The concept. So this first half of 2021, Blue Hill at Stone Barns, which is Chef Dan Barber's acclaimed farm-to-table restaurant, two Michelin star restaurant, fabulous place. They've transformed into a chef-in-residence program that's supporting new resident chefs for five-week periods. And the chefs are collaborating with Stone Barns Center farmers and other Hudson Valley producers to bring their unique culinary perspectives to our regional landscape. So this, I went for a lunch and the chef was Omar Tate, and he was Esquire Magazine's 2020 Chef of the Year, who's also a deeply insightful poet and artist. And so why did I go? Well, I've always wanted to try Chef Omar's food. I've read a lot about him, and it was also my birthday, and recently I decided to treat myself. So my experience, I made a reservation for one on Talk. This is you pay in advance. I booked it about 3 weeks ahead. I went for a late lunch on Saturday. Everything, you know, once you got to the property, you started in what they called the living room, which had art that inspired Chef Omar's menu. It was given a pamphlet that described the art and the inspiration. And it said, this menu is a reflection of social themes that he has been navigating throughout life, but amplified in the year of 2020. So the story began there. Then I was led into the main dining room. There were only about seven tables that they were occupying. It was indoor dining, but it was very socially distanced tables, and it's just a lovely, beautiful dining room. I had a really great experience. Omar, I was able to meet the chef. He brought a dish out. We were able to chat. And afterward, I walked around the property a little bit too. So what did I get? So he had a tasting menu that started out with Kool-Aid, and they also did a pairing for me with some non-alcoholic beverages throughout the meal. One of them was a tasty burnt lemon tonic that was really delicious. And the menu was an exploration of blackness in America through the lens of Northeastern migration. And some of the dishes were Notes from a Black Pantry, A Still Life. There was Untitled, A Toad in the Hole for Latasha Harlins. There was a extravaganza, the chorus at the end is barbecue, which was way more than I could eat. And then desserts, it was a buttermilk ice cream, a classic cake, and coffee with cabin spice ice cream. And of course, it had to end with honeysuckle ice cream. They also sent me and everyone home with two fresh breads. So my take, it was wonderful. It was a really amazing experience. And I have to say, solo dining, tasting menus, are the way to go. I mean, not always, but I think you really get to take in the experience because you're just there to enjoy the creations of the chef. And so I was glad I went. The ambiance is a gorgeous farmhouse dining room. It has lots of natural light and windows in the farm setting in the background. And as I said, there were very socially distanced tables. In the center of the room, they had a table that had memorabilia that the chef put together. And also they were playing a soundtrack that the chef put together. And normally at Stone Barns, they have no music. So it was a unique experience. I'd say it's perfect for food lovers who appreciate a story behind the cuisine. Interesting tidbit, Honeysuckle, which was a pop-up in Philadelphia, will eventually become a community center in West Philly with a mission of claiming space for Black food in America. And also, interesting tidbit, Omar's mom and family was dining there when I was there too. So that was cool. Personal fun fact, I dined at Blue Hill Stone Barns once before, and it was like 10 years ago. It was a while. And I was with a group of friends, and it goes down in history. It's the longest meal I've ever had because we were there for over 7 hours. And I was with the chef at the table. So I know we got sent out some extra courses then, but it was incredible, but it was long. This meal, this lunch was about 3 hours. So the cost of the meal was $250. That's not including the tax on it and 22% admin fee. Would I go back? Yes, their website is stonebarnscenter.org. And so that's my splurge. My splurge, the biggest one I've had in over a year. And if people want to check it out, the upcoming chefs are Johnny Ortiz and Victoria Blamey from New York City, as coming up. So if you've heard about this,
yes, it sounds so cool. And I agree, the length of meals like that is sometimes a little taxing, especially after a year of not having proper sit down meals. But sometimes worth the time and the expense.
Yeah. Yeah. It was again, like, this is not, I haven't dined like this in a long time, and it happened to go by pretty fast, I would say. You know, it was a quick 3 hours, which might sound weird, but
no, it makes sense.
And he was lovely. I really appreciated that. I got to meet Chef Omar, and we talked about him possibly coming on my show in the future. So. I'm going to have to follow up about that. Cool. Okay. So it's time for the final question. So my next guests are chef and owner Chris Cipollone and owner and operator John Winterman of Francie, which is a neighborhood brasserie and destination restaurant in South Williamsburg, Brooklyn, that debuted in December after being delayed. I think they were originally supposed to open in April, and then they opened, and then indoor dining closed, and they had to shut, and now they're open again. So I'm excited to chat with them about what's been happening with the opening of Francie. But Amanda, what would you like to ask Chris and John?
I guess I wonder how this experience of opening during a pandemic has maybe permanently altered their outlook on their business and this industry, and if there's something that's fundamentally changed about how they see the industry even after all this is over.
Cool. I will find out. Awesome. I mean, yeah, it's a great question. They're both such experienced restaurateurs, and this has certainly been a new experience for them and everyone. So but thank you so much for joining me today. You're amazing, and I love Eater and everything you do. So, I wish you much continued success.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. This was a pure joy.
Oh, good. I'm so glad. And I hope to see you sooner than later. I miss
me
that.
Too. Someday this year, I'm sure.
Yeah. We will see each other again in person.
Love it.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sherry.
My guest today has been Amanda Klute. She's the editor-in-chief of Eater and a senior vice president at Vox Media. Website is eater.com, and you can follow her on social media at Klute. That's K-L-U-D-T. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. My websites are bayerpublicrelations.com. SherryBayer.com and allintheindustry.com. All of our shows are archived at heritageradionetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Amanda Wang, and thanks again to my guest, Amanda Klute. I'm Sherry Bayer. I'm taking next week off, so I will be back with a new show on Wednesday, March 24th. That will be with Chris and John. So I hope you'll tune in then. Stay safe and well, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.